Sufferings, it's your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. It was brought to you by our good friends at River, the best place to buy Bitcoin. River makes it very easy to buy Bitcoin, to sell Bitcoin. If you want to do that, you shouldn't sell it. They actually have a new thing at checkout if you're trying to sell Bitcoin. Michael Saylor comes out and says, are you sure you want to sell Bitcoin right now? Probably shouldn't. You should DCA into Bitcoin. River makes it very easy. You can set it and forget it by daily, weekly, monthly. If you DCA using River, you're not going to pay any fees on those buys. It's the easiest way to gift Bitcoin with River Link. You set an amount of Bitcoin you want to gift somebody. You create a link. You send that to somebody. You text it to them. You email it to them. You DM it to them. They click the link, and then they can sweep the Bitcoin to their River account or a wallet of their choice. It's a beautiful thing. River builds all their infrastructure in-house. They don't depend on third parties. It's the best place to buy Bitcoin. It's where we buy Bitcoin. Go to river.com/TFTC. Sign up today. You'll get $5 worth of Bitcoin. This rip was also brought to you by good friends down the hall, Unchained. Unchained is here to help you eliminate single points of failure in your custody model. Price of Bitcoin's going up. If you talked about owning Bitcoin publicly, you could be subjected to SIM swap attacks. Had a friend had this happen to him recently where he got SIM swapped attack. They went to go drain his exchanges, got past 2FA, all of that. Luckily, they didn't get his Bitcoin because he has his Bitcoin in an Unchained multisig vault, which keeps your keys offline, and they're always in cold storage. So you don't have to worry about somebody SIM swapping you and stealing your Bitcoin. Unchained also has an IRA product. If you have a retirement account and you want to get exposure to Bitcoin, get direct exposure. You don't have to buy the ETFs. You can actually hold the Bitcoin, take it in kind, as one should be able to do. Unchained makes that very easy. Go hit up Unchained's concierge team. Go to unchained.com/consultation. Learn about all their products, the vault, the IRA. They have a trading desk. They have a lending desk. They're doing it the right way. Unchained.com/consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're an individual out there who wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, Zaprite is the best way to do that. Go to zaprite.com/TFTC, set up an account, and Zaprite makes it very easy to connect your own wallets. They're wallet agnostic. You simply enter an XPub, connect your LND node, connect your Strike account, whatever it may be, and Zaprite handles the invoicing side of things. You can send invoices, payment links. They have a WooCommerce integration. So if you're a trucker, a rancher, a farmer, a doctor, a lawyer wants to accept Bitcoin as payment, go to Zaprite, connect your wallets, and start doing so today. The best part about Zaprite is they also accept fiat payments, so you don't have to have individual invoicing for people that pay in Bitcoin and people that pay in fiat. You do it all in one spot. You can connect Stripe, your ACH, and you send one invoice, and they can pay in fiat or Bitcoin. It's beautifully designed. They have they have dashboards, analytics, everything you need to hand over to your bookkeeper or your accountant. So again, go to zaprite.com/TFTC. Use the promo code TFTC at sign out, and you're going to get $40 off their annual subscription fee, which is typically $240. So with the code TFTC, you drop that down to $200. Zaprite.com/TFTC. Last but not least, this rip was brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. Bull market's here. You may be looking to hire as your runway is extended because you have a bunch of Bitcoin on your corporate treasury. Go to Bitcoin Talent Co. It's a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. They understand Bitcoin multisig. They understand mining. They understand the Lightning Network, and they're highly competent recruiters. Andy, the co-founder, started Uber, grew their team from 100 to 10,000. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to go find the best talent in tech, design, banking, finance, whatever you need. They're going to understand your needs, and they're going to go get you the best talent to help us build out the Bitcoin standard. BitcoinTalent.co. Tell them the TFTC sent you and enjoy this rip.
Okay.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
There's a lot going on in the world, particularly as it pertains to oil and gas.
Absolutely.
But let's start with the Strategic Petroleum Reserves. I just saw a clip of Peter Ducey asking the White House press secretary about the Biden administration's plans to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, which have been drained over the last few years. And she hand-waved away the question and said, hey, that's the Department of Energy. What's going on with the Strategic Petroleum Reserves in America right now?
Generally speaking, let's start from the beginning. When President, and I am, whenever, whatever I say, I am being apolitical. When the Biden administration withdrew oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserves, and they got 180 million, and then there were about 31 million that were mandated by the Congress. So the total was about 211 million barrels that been withdrawn in 2002. If you look at the situation, it is very clear that the Biden administration knew about the plans of Putin to invade Ukraine. So in August 2021, they contacted the Saudis and other Gulf states asking them to increase production under the guise that we have a recovery from COVID, the high oil prices are not good for the world economy, etc. For us, basically, we thought that the negotiations with Iran were not going very well, and probably they will harden the sanctions on Iran, and therefore they want someone else to compensate for the Iranian crude. So that's our thinking at that time. It was related to Iran, has nothing to do with the economy or gasoline prices. Prices were relatively low, probably in like 60 to 70s. So it did not make sense to focus on gasoline prices and the recovery. It made more sense at that time to look into negotiation with Iran regarding the nuclear program. What we knew later was that Putin was planning to invade Ukraine in December 2021. But because the Olympics in China, the president of China basically asked Putin to delay the invasion so they won't tarnish the Olympics in China. So the invasion was delayed until February. During this time, the Biden administration shopped around and tried to put pressure on various countries, including the Saudis, to increase production, and they refused. Now, Putin goes to Ukraine, and all of a sudden we have this massive rumor that Russian production will decline by 3 to 5 million barrels a day. And prices skyrocketed from $80 to $130. But there was no actual decline. There was no actual cut. All this increase was on the rumor that we would lose 3 to 5 million. We did not lose that amount. In fact, even when we look at 2023, when people were expecting that decline, the decline was 250,000 barrels a day, and that's it. We were the first, basically, to tell people, look, there will be no decline. We studied sanctions. We looked at sanctions over 120 years. Sanctions never work. And the idea that the Russian production will decline by 3 to 5 million barrels a day because of sanctions was complete nonsense. Anyway, we ended up with a situation where the Biden administration, along with the International Energy Agency, were convinced that production will decline by 3 to 5 million barrels a day. Prices now are at 130. The Saudis and others are not responding because they don't want to break up OPEC Plus, which Russia is part of it. So there was no other choice in front of the Biden administration except to use the SPR. Now, why this is important? Why they did not ask Latin America or South American countries? Well, they did not ask South American countries because they're all maxed out and there is no additional production they can bring online. They did not ask Canada because Canada does not have any spare capacity. They did not ask U.S. producers because U.S. producers were producing at capacity. In addition, all the shale is producing light sweet crude while the market needed medium sour and heavy. So there was no other choice because the spare capacity was in Saudi Arabia and neighboring countries. Those countries refused to cooperate. So what do you do? So he decided to withdraw from the SPR. And for the first time in history, we've seen a recommendation I made to the White House 20 years ago, which is, if you look at the literature of the SPR and you look at all the releases, there was no impact, or if there is any impact, it is very limited. Even the government studies show that the impact could be 1 cent to 5 cents decline in gasoline prices, which is very, very limited. So the suggestion 20 years ago was, if you really want to release oil from the SPR, you have to release massive amount with a certain statement saying that I will not stop until prices decline. Something like, we are going to dump 1 million barrels a day on the market for 6 months. These statements are very important. Earlier statements, when you look at the Clinton years or the Bush years, they were very dull. Like, we have a problem and we decided to release 30 million barrels and that's it. So they did it right. So that's the first thing. The second issue here is the impact was massive. Now, Biden did not drain the SPR because we still have about 345 million barrels, which is more than enough for any emergency. We have no problem. So he did not drain it. And in fact, if you look at the history, especially for the last 10 years from 2022, so since 2012, what do you see? Even earlier, if you go back to the 90s, Newt Gingrich and others, they wanted to close the Department of Energy and they wanted to sell the whole SPR. If you look at Rick Perry, who was the governor of Texas, who was a presidential candidate and he became Trump's energy secretary, he wanted to close the Department of Energy and sell all the SPR. And if you look at Trump in 2017 wanted to sell half of the SPR, which is more than what Biden sold. If you look at the last 10 years from 2022, which is from 2012, there were many Republican and Democrat politicians who were saying the following. He said, look, now we have the shale revolution. The shale revolution brought in massive amount of oil. It brought in about 9 million barrels a day. So multiply that by 365. You can see the amount that it brought in 1 year, which is multiples of what we have in the SPR. So why we are holding the taxpayer money, why we are holding this the SPR, especially the light sweet crude. I have massive amount underground. I am exporting 4 to 5 million barrels right now of light sweet crude. Why I have to keep light sweet crude? I don't need it. So there were calls since 2012 to reduce the size of the SPR, especially the light sweet crude, because I am producing and exporting massive amount of it. So it made perfect sense. So what happened with the Biden administration is that it really capitalized on all these things together, and then they released that amount. Now, they lied about the cost when they said they focused on the idea that, look, we sold the oil at 95 and now we are buying it at 72, later at 79, and therefore we save the taxpayer money. Why they lied? Because that in business, that's not the way you do it. You got to tell me the original cost. Even when you work with your stocks, you want to look for your basis. So what are the basis for the oil that's being sold at 95? I did the calculations. It's over $200, which means that every barrel of oil that the Biden administration sold, we lost money on. But that's the financial accounting. If you look at the economic benefits worldwide, not only in the United States, worldwide, prices declined because of the SPR and because of other factors from 130 to 80. So we have $50 decline. Of course, not all of it to the SPR, but there could be $20 to $25 due to the SPR. So you measure the impact of that on the U.S. economy. You measure the impact of savings for people. You measure the impact of savings for the government, for the military, and for other nations. You find out that the benefits, the economic benefits outweigh the financial losses that I talked about. At the same time, you look at the strategic value. Biden, with the SPR, he saved Europe from Putin. He kept the European Union united. What is the price of that? Otherwise, you'd have seen U.S. Army somewhere in Europe right now, and you'll see U.S. Army fighting. What is the price of that? Not happening. So the strategic value and the economic value of that release is so huge. It's, in fact, it's priceless and outweigh any financial losses from that shit. The problem is they couldn't manage the PR for that SPR refill. They kept making statements that did not materialize. They kept saying contradictory statements, refill, 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 refill. Finally, they started refilling at a very high prices. I mean, and the idea, and we mentioned this in some of our reports, that the only way the Biden administration was buying oil at 79, if they have guarantees from other nations that prices will not go below 79, which means that those prices that we see today near 90, the Biden administration knew about them 3, 4, 5 months ago. The other issue that when they are, when they said that they are going to refill the SPR, there was a kind of a gimmick accounting they were playing, because they said by the end of the year, by the end of 2024, we would refill the SPR. Of course, they are refilling 100,000 barrels a day, and that's it. There is no way they can return 180 million. But what is the gimmick accounting? The gimmick accounting basically is the Congress mandated the sales of certain amount every year of the SPR. So they canceled that. And the Biden administration is saying, well, look, we canceled that. You get to count that in the refill. Huh. And therefore, by the time of the elections, they can claim that they literally refilled that. So if you look at it on an Excel sheet, they did. But the reality, it did not.
Okay, so to better understand, the Congress released the amount, or basically made it so you don't have to account for the amount that you're allowed to sell per year. So that brings...
So the Congress mandated the sales. The Congress mandated the sales. And then they canceled it. And this cancellation, the Biden administration is claiming it as a credit. Okay? So that's one part of the game. However, the issue that we discussed today in the Daily Energy Report is the following. Now they stopped. Now, this was predicted, because if prices go up in August and September, what they are going to do? They have to release oil from the SPR. But technically, they cannot fill and withdraw at the same time. So they have to stop refilling first and withdraw second. So the question now is, are they going to withdraw again in August and September? Again, from our point of view, we wrote this in our reports in months ago, that they, if prices go up, and our threshold is this, $4 gasoline. $4, that's national average. $4 gasoline translates to 90 WTI. Of course, these are approximate numbers. So $4, $90 WTI. If WTI goes 90 or above, then the Biden administration will withdraw oil from the SPR in August and September. Our estimate, they will draw about 30 million barrels. And in today's report, basically, we discussed the impact. There is a very limited impact to the decision not to refill and to the decision to release oil from the SPR. When you talk about 30 million, even to up to 60 million, the impact is very limited. But politically speaking, it makes sense to them. So that's the whole story.
And this is in the mainstream narrative. So there's, on the front end, it seems like they actually handled it okay, from an even though they sold the oil at a loss, but the net benefit for the U.S. economy and the global economy on the temporary cost savings was good. But now they find themselves in a pickle on the back end with the narrative around refilling it. in the economy.
I am surprised. I mean, that's where they messed up the PR really big time. The Biden administration has a big story to tell about the economic benefits and the strategic benefits. Big story. Why they ignored it, I have no idea. Why they did not talk about it, I have no idea. But the reality, they did keep Europe united. They did not make those countries yield to Putin's demand. And that's thanks to the share revolution on one side and thanks to the SPR release on the other.
Well, another part of this too, which makes this even more perplexing, is the LNG exports, correct? Because that was a big factor in holding Europe over throughout the energy crisis they had in the wake of the war.
I'm going to tell you and tell your audience another story, because I think this is another story missing from the mainstream media. In 2014, Putin annexed Crimea, and the United States and Europe imposed sanctions on Putin, which affected some of his gas exports. That was a problem. The Chinese approached him and said, let's build this pipeline and, you know, solve your problems, etc. And at the same time, they said, well, why you don't send some of oil, of your oil to Asia? And once the Russians have a taste of Asia, there was no way back, whether on oil or gas. Now, Putin, through his intelligence services in the United States, realized that the shale revolution is going to bring a lot of gas. And he found out that there was a plan within the United States, let's call it the deep state plan. And I'm talking about 2014 here, to replace Russian gas in Europe with US LNG. Remember, all the plants that we are talking about, now they are sending that LNG to Europe. They got the approvals at that time. So he knew about the US plan to replace gas in Europe. So what his reaction was, he improved his relationship with Angela Merkel in Germany. They quickly built that pipeline, which is Nord Stream 2. They spent billions of dollars. They've done everything possible to secure their gas market in Europe. But we have enough evidence to show that the shale revolution was unstoppable. The deep state in the United States with the shale revolution led to the increase in U.S. LNG exports. And over time, with the we've seen Trump all of a sudden becoming the chief marketer of U.S. LNG. Now you are talking about the head of the nation, marketing an industry. Wherever you see, you go back to YouTube and watch every visit of Trump to Europe and every meeting with any European leader, he talked about LNG. Now you have Biden coming to office. Politically speaking, he's on the other side of the spectrum. He is against fossil fuel. He's against oil. He is against gas. All of a sudden, he continued the role of Trump as being the chief marketer of LNG.
Yeah.
So both of them did exactly the same job. That tells you that the deep state basically is working here. As a result, what happened? Putin underestimated the impact of the U.S. will to replace Russian gas in Europe. Of course, not totally, but U.S. exports to Europe were zero a few years ago. Now, almost 21% of gas imports in Europe coming from the United States. So what happened is, as a result of this, in 2016, when oil prices collapsed in 2015 and 2016, OPEC decided, I'm not going to do it alone. Other non-OPEC members have to join. Otherwise, I'm going to crash the market and keep crashing it. Saudis increased their production. Iraqis increased their production. Iranians, because of the deal with Obama at that time, increased their production. So there was no way for countries like Kazakhstan or Azerbaijan or Russia except to join. and they formed OPEC Plus in 2016. Now they started meeting and they decided to cut production. In every single meeting, Russia wanted a smaller cut. And in some cases, they don't want to cut at all. Period. They don't want to. And there was a clash between them and the Saudis. And as you recall, there was a price war in March 7th, 2020, when because of that. Because the Russians basically have a different view on prices in the market than the Saudis. Why? Because their intelligence told them that most of the additional gas in the United States that's going to LNG terminals is associated gas coming from oil fields. So if you raise oil prices, you end up with massive amount of gas. And producers will dump that gas on the market at any price because they make their money from oil. And therefore, you can ship cheap gas to Europe and be competitive no matter what. So the only way to cap that gas from competing with the Russian gas in Europe and make Nord Stream 2 successful is to keep oil prices at 60 and prevent that growth in shale. So, yes, it was Russia who was fighting shale. It wasn't the Saudis. It wasn't OPEC. It was the Russians. And in fact, and I'm going to say this statement, and I know some people are going to get angry at me. If you look at some of the largest consulting agencies, at certain period of time, every person who was the head of gas or specialist in gas was Russian.
Huh.
I'm talking about American and European companies.
Interesting.
It is interesting because they really, that's their game. They wanted to halt the expansion of oil production so they can lower the production of associated gas so LNG won't boom the same way it did.
And so let's fast forward to today.
So just one statement.
Okay.
So the conflict, so one of the ironies is the conflict within OPEC Plus between the Saudis and the Russians, although OPEC Plus is about oil, the cause of the conflict is the gas, not oil.
Can you ever really separate oil and gas? Or are they always going to be interlinked because of the associated gas?
Of course. And this is why we never have a dull moment in our field. And the reason why, because you produce oil and gas together, so they are complements. But once you go to the market, in some cases, they are substitutes. So they are complements on one side and substitutes on one side, and now solve it. It's a serious problem.
And you have all these moving variables in different areas of production around the world with different incentives.
Speaking of a lot of moving variables, I would like to add one thing to your audience that is not in the mainstream media or analysts do not talk about. What we've seen since 2022 is that the level of competition among energy sources increased to levels that we never ever seen before. I'm going to give you true examples, real life examples. In 2021, in May 2021, all of a sudden the wind stopped in most parts of the UK. Just stopped. And they depend heavily on wind. And as a result, now they want to look for another source. Otherwise, they will have power outages. What the other source was? Natural gas. And natural gas prices increased to record high. And power prices increased to record high. That was the beginning of the energy crisis in Europe, even before the invasion of Ukraine. But what we've seen here is because the price of gas increased, now other countries wanted to get the LNG. LNG's prices start increasing. Now you move to 2022 with the issues with the Russian gas, etc. What we saw basically is massive increase in LNG prices. All of a sudden, China and India found out they need to go back to coal because it's too expensive to buy the gas. We started with wind. Now we are going back to coal because LNG is very expensive. So they ended up with coal. We ended up with another problem. All of a sudden, we have a major drought. A major drought, that means hydro is going down. And because hydro is going down, that means the demand for natural gas and coal is going to increase. So this level of substitution between the various energy sources, we never seen before. And this is something we've been studying only from 2022. And it is a very interesting phenomenon. And we have too many variables, like you said, too many variables. To make it more complex, and this is, again, we are talking about real life examples. We have a drought on one side, LNG prices are very high, and China has no choice but to go for a kind of managed brownouts. Okay, my area basically has no power. I have a factory. I already have orders now after COVID. I have orders for the next 3 years. I cannot even lose 1 hour. I'm working 24/7. I cannot even lose 1 hour of production, and now I have no power. What do? You resort to private generation. And what private generation uses?
Diesel.
Diesel or some sort of LPG or others. And all of a sudden, the demand for oil increased. So this level of substitution and sophistication, we never seen before.
Intuitively, you think that with a more hyper-competitive market, it would drive prices down. But it seems like you're getting at the idea that the fact that there's so much substitution possible, there could be over-index on one form of a substitute against another, which creates these massive pricing disconnections.
Absolutely. And we end up with, in fact, if you want to go into the details of this, here is, again, real-life example. You have two industries, but both of them are serving Apple to make the iPhone. Okay. One of them got stuck with the very expensive LNG, and the other one basically is buying the cheap coal. And both of them basically supply the same supplier. So the cost of one part basically is going up, the other cost of the cost of the other part is going down.
It sort of evens out.
Well, it depends, but I'm just kind of giving you one example on the complexity of these issues.
Mm-hmm. And this bring this back to LNG. If Putin had the wherewithal in 2014, 2016 to recognize that the shale revolution was going to lead to this massive market for LNG coming out of the U.S. to markets that it had previously dominated, why would the Biden administration, which seems hell-bent on preventing Russia from succeeding in their efforts in Ukraine, shut down LNG production in the U.S. if it seems like it is a good mechanism to, quote-unquote, weaken Russia economically by creating competition in the sale of LNG?
Well, that's what really happened. I mean, that's actually what they did. They just kept increasing LNG production, and Russian gas became cheaper as a result of that. So that's happened. But let me add kind of a futuristic view so the audience know what are the Putin plans, especially with his new term of presidency. Putin realized about 2 years ago, like a few months after the invasion, that he put all his eggs in one basket. And he is depending heavily on China. The Chinese basically are opportunistic. They say, okay, well, I'm going to take the cheap Russian gas, I'm going to take the cheap Russian oil, etc. Now they have those pipelines, they are building more pipelines. So the Russian realized that from an energy security point of view, from economic security point of view, and from geostrategic point of view, they have to diversify exports. And they studied the landscape, especially when the ban was imposed by the EU and by the US on importing oil from Russia. And then another ban on importing products from Russia. By the way, Russian oil still reaches the United States and Europe even today in one way or the other. I'll explain that later. But the idea here is he wanted to find new markets. And they literally shipped were shopping around the world for markets, and they learned very important lessons. As a result, they ended up with two conclusions. The first conclusion is selling crude oil is not a good idea. And the reason why, because most of your new customers are needy customers. They are poorer countries in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, and there are many of them. They can solve your problem, but they don't have refineries. So what they are going to do with the crude? So you are limited in your sales because many of those countries who are willing to do the political sacrifice and buy from you, they don't have refineries. And therefore, their view right now is, I'm going to build more refineries than ever so I can ship products because the final consumer is going to take the final product and I can ship it anywhere. So now Ukraine is hitting refineries because this is a strategic choice for Russia. So you are not hitting refineries, you are hitting a strategic decision, a strategic policy. That's number one. Number two, they knew that they have a serious problem with their gas, that they have a lot of gas. They don't want to depend only on China, because if you end up with a recession in China, Russia is toast. If they end up with a political disagreement, Russia is toast. So they want to ship that gas. On the ground, the only way you can use pipelines, either west or east. That's it. That's the world for Russia. East to China, west to Europe. Europe is almost closed. Almost, because even today, Ukraine still uses Russian gas. And for those who are interested in the numbers, we have all the numbers on our Substack. And even today, Russian gas is shipped through Ukraine to Europe. And even today, Russians are getting paid by Europeans for their gas. So you talk about sanctions, don't brag about it much. Anyway, the idea here is the only way you can sell your gas around the world is through liquefying that gas. And therefore, you want to build more liquefaction plants so you can ship this gas anywhere in the world. And this way, you can diversify your exports. The Biden administration realized that this is a very important strategic decision for Russia. And therefore, they are doing their best now to block any company from helping the Russians build their Arctic LNG too. Mm. So don't think about it just like, okay, well, I am a politician, I just want to do sanctions. No, there are deeper issues than that. This is a strategic decision by Biden to diversify, and it is a strategic decision by the Biden administration. No, I'm going to kill your strategic options. Period.
So is the idea...
At the same time, there is a fear, because sending this LNG to Europe and controlling about 20% of European market, this is engraved in stone. This is not something temporary. This is for the next few decades, and it has implications. One of the implications is, what if the war in Ukraine ends tomorrow and sanctions on Russia ends in a year, or just countries ignore the sanctions? Then Russian LNG will compete with the US LNG because it's cheaper. So the US, by blocking Arctic LNG 2 and any efforts by the Russians to build more LNG plants, guarantees two things. First of all, they had their strategic decision to diversify. On the other side, they guarantee their market for the future, the U.S. market for the future in Europe, because they don't want the Russian gas to compete with it. And that's another impact.
How does that prevent the Russians from spinning up LNG facilities? Would they have to leverage American companies to actually build this, or?
Well, it could be any company, especially the big companies. You have the construction companies on one side, and you need the major oil companies on the other, like French Total and Eni and others. You want to guarantee a market for it to finance it. Probably they need to work that out too. So there are several issues related to it. By the Biden administration imposing several layers of sanctions that can influence the decision of foreign companies through those multi-layered sanctions not to invest in the new LNG plants.
Quick break here, freaks. This rip is brought to you by Gradually Then Suddenly, a framework for understanding Bitcoin as money by Parker Lewis. I wrote the foreword to the book. I'm honored to have done so because it's the best 0-to-1 primer if you're looking for a logical explanation of why Bitcoin obsoletes all other money. Buy one for yourself and maybe a few for your friends. Go to thesafehouse.com/gradually. That's thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com/gradually. Use the promo code TFTC for $5 off at checkout. Buy it now, freaks. The price of Bitcoin is going up. You need to understand it. This is the best 0-to-1 primer. Back to the show.
And so what's Russia's move now? Do they have to find solace in OPEC Plus and attempt to?
No, not really. I think the Russians' options are very clear, at least to me, that they will go for refinery diversification no matter what, despite the attacks by Ukraine. By the way, there are certain media outlets, without naming names, they are exaggerating the impact of the attacks on the refineries. They are exaggerating big time.
Why do you say that?
We have enough evidence to show it, basically, and we discuss those in our reports, daily reports. For example, I'm going to give you some examples. There, certain outlet basically will say, look, Russians send a drone to this refinery. Well, a refinery, sometimes a refinery could be like 60, 70 acre, okay? And they hit one unit in that refinery, but still it is an attack, okay? And that unit could be even idle. So what the outlet, the news outlet would say, like, refinery was attacked and it export this and this and this and this, and their capacity is 360,000 barrels a day. But what's affected basically is just a unit that produces only 10,000. But they never say that. They tell you about the total capacity. And the level of utilization of Russian refineries is low relative to the U.S. So no one knows whether they are in maintenance, they are operational. There, we don't know the true impact. But what we know is we get the export numbers on daily basis and on weekly basis. And we can tell from the export numbers that those media outlets are exaggerating the impact of the attacks. At the same time, they are ignoring one fact. If Russian refineries are hit and they really cannot process crude, yes, their exports of products like diesel and others will decline. But since they cannot process the crude, now their crude exports will increase. So that's why you see the Russians playing a very nasty game with OPEC Plus, because what they did is they went to the meeting and all the agreements within OPEC itself since 1982, all the agreements are on production. Then OPEC Plus came in 2016, all the agreements were on production. When the Russian refineries started being hit, the Russians changed the game and said, I want to cut from exports, not from production. And they started playing that game.
So where does this... like, what's your perspective on how OPEC Plus views Russia and all this? Are they annoyed that they're engaged in this war and creating all these externalities within the oil and gas market? Because that's, one of the big themes is, particularly on the monetary side, after the freezing of the Russian treasury assets, one of the narratives is that OPEC Plus, the BRICS countries predominantly, are getting together and saying, hey, we need to separate ourselves from this monetary system and make sure that we have our financial assets and things that we actually control. And a part of that narrative is that they're going along with Russia, and Russia is like a part of these discussions and a pivotal part of them, at the very least. Is this not the case?
No, there are 2 points here. The first point is Russia, since 2016, Russia never, ever delivered voluntarily on the cuts. They did not. And whenever they cut, simply because they have maintenance or they have problems. But without that, they never voluntarily, like Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, or UAE, voluntarily cut production. They never did. Okay. So you start asking the question, then what the Saudis want from Russia? What OPEC wants from Russia? We can guess. And I'm going to give you a couple of benefits. It's not only about oil. There are more than oil into the equation. For example, as you know, since the George W. Bush years, we have this proposal in the Congress to sue OPEC. It's called an OPEC or no OPEC, which means that they want to use the Sherman Act, which is only to the companies within the borders of the United States. They want to extend that globally and sue OPEC and OPEC members based on it. But they need the approval of the Congress. And once they get the approval of the Congress and the Senate, then the President of the United States has to sign it. George W. Bush ignored it. Obama ignored it. During the Trump administration, it wasn't even processed because of the pressure from Trump, although Trump in his book in 2011 supported it. Anyway, the idea here is if you bring in Russia, Putin, and all the other countries, whom you are going to sue now? Okay. Yes, the other countries are probably weaker than Russia, etc. But now, are you going to sue Putin in U.S. courts? Good luck. So that's number one. Number two, if you look at what Russia did in the Security Councils, because we have the five permanent members of the Security Council, and Russia is one of them. Look at the benefits to the two OPEC members from it. First, we have the issues related to the war in Yemen. And there was a proposal, if it passed, it would have been a disaster for Saudi Arabia and the UAE and other members of the GCC Council, the Gulf Cooperation Council. Who vetoed that? Russia. So what is the price of that? Because that would have criminalized those countries. The second one, there was a vote on climate change. And Russia vetoed that. What is the price of that? So there are other benefits to cooperating with Russia. It's not only about oil and whether they comply or not. So there are these benefits. Now we are finding out there are more into it. Now the Saudis, the Algerians, all of them are OPEC members. The Iraqis, they want nuclear. They want nuclear power plants. They know there is no way on earth the U.S. Congress will grant any Arab country, American technology. I'm talking about the nuclear technology. Even the UAE, when they built it through a South Korean company, not an American company. So they know this is not going to happen. South Korea does not have the political muscle, basically, to help them, but Russia does. So what you see right now is you see Egypt is building nuclear plants by the Russians. Turkey is building nuclear plants by the Russians. They are going to start theirs, I think, in next month. And Algeria now is preparing the legal framework to start building nuclear plants, and the Russians are going to build it. So there are other benefits. It's not only about oil.
The Russians don't really have a great track record of building and maintaining nuclear power plants.
Absolutely.
Has it gotten better since Chernobyl?
Well, it depends on how you look at Chernobyl, because some people will tell you it's Ukrainian.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, and you mentioned Yemen earlier, too. That's a whole other aspect we haven't even touched on yet, which is what's happening in the Red Sea with the Houthi rebels and how that plays into this overarching conversation we've been having. That's seems to be a pretty big event that was highly focused on over Christmas and the first month of this year, but it seems to have been brushed under the rug of the mainstream media, but it still is going on in earnest. I believe the Houthi rebels told China and Russia specifically that their ships going through the Suez Canal would not be attacked.
Since day one, we published few reports and we had several podcasts with top experts in the world on the Red Sea and the Houthis. For those who are interested, those are available free on our Substack, and they can listen to them and watch them. The issue is like the media is talking about the Houthis, attacks on ships, shipping industry, etc. Look, the Houthis are a subgroup of a subgroup of a minority. So to tell me the US and the UK cannot control that group does not make sense. To tell me that Iran can control it, but the US and the UK cannot control it does not make sense. So I'm going to tell you a third story today from A to Z. Since the sanctions being imposed on Russia because of its invasion of Ukraine, the importance of the Red Sea increased substantially to the extent that it became the hottest area on Earth. And this is even before the Gaza war, before the Houthi attacks. So what happened? We have several issues here. You have the climate change policies on one side, and you have the Russian sanctions on the other. So look what happened. First, the Russians used to export to Asia about 250,000 barrels a day through the Red Sea. So that will come out of the Turkish Straits. They cross the Mediterranean through the Suez Canal, go south in the Red Sea, Bab el-Mandeb, and then from there to Asia. Only 250. After the sanctions, it increased to an average of 1.7 million barrels a day.
Oh.
Okay. So the number of oil tankers going through increased substantially, and they are Russians. Now, Europe does not have enough oil. So now the Gulf countries need to send oil to Europe instead of Asia. So they have to reroute too. So we have more oil tankers going north in the Red Sea through the Suez Canal than before. As a result, in 2023, we have the largest number of tankers passing through the Suez Canal, and the canal generated the biggest revenues in its history as a result of these things. But it's not only about oil. We have LNG too. So Qatar, for example, started sending LNG to Europe instead of Asia. So increased traffic again. But that's not the only story. During this period, we talked earlier about US LNG. We, for the US, as you know, the oil production increased and exports reached record high in 2023. That oil and that LNG was going through the Red Sea too. At the same time, that green transition, China needed all those minerals and metals from Africa, Latin America, and other countries. A large portion of it was going through the Red Sea. Now they are exporting the solar panels, everything needed for wind power, and they are exporting the EV batteries and electric vehicles, especially to Europe. That's through the Red Sea. So the old energy and the new energy is going through the Red Sea. So the importance of the Red Sea is historic. And it became the hottest area in the world. It has everything in it. It has Russia, it has China, and it has everything you need from the old energy, everything you need for the new energy. What that means is you need to go back to the old ways to control the Red Sea. I'm not talking about conspiracy here. This is what the history of nations throughout history is, to control the waterways. So this is not a conspiracy. Well, you don't want to go to the Suez Canal because it is owned by Egypt, and you don't want to go and fight with Egypt. You don't want to kind of infringe on the sovereignty of other countries. So you don't want that. At the same time, you don't want to be near Somalia and Yemen because of all that history. Remember the Black Hawk thing in Somalia and the Houthis and all the troubles, etc. You don't have to mess with that. What you can do is control what's in between, which is the Red Sea. And there are other circumstantial evidence to support this point. Saudi Arabia refused. Egypt refused to participate. So we are, and the UK basically withdrew most of its ships anyway. So we are left to the United States, but the United States wants to be there. This is the hottest area in the world. You can control China, you can control Russia, you can control the Arab world. You can control everything by controlling the Red Sea right now. And you can control the energy transition on one side, and you can control the flow of LNG and oil on the other. The fleet that went to the Red Sea went to stop the Houthis. But that was what? Months ago, 3 months ago. And the number of ships that are going through there is declining by the day, and we have only some tankers from Russia and Saudi Arabia, and that's it. But that was not the objective. I forgot to mention one point that made the Red Sea hotter than ever. As you know, we had that drought in the Panama Canal, and shippers were not able to go through it. That diverted some shipments to the Suez Canal too, through the Red Sea. So if you look at it, any way you look at it, the Red Sea was the hottest area, and that deep state that I mentioned earlier probably thought that need to be controlled, and that's why they are there.
And so with that in mind, like, what is the ultimate goal? We're thinking deep state, long-term thinking. So now the people can't go through the Suez Canal. They're forced to go around the Horn of Africa. Like, so,
well, everything we see today is temporary. This is all, everything we see today is short run. Okay. The plan is for decades. So this is not, don't focus only on the short run and the Houthi attacks. The Houthis are temporary phenomenon. The war in Gaza is temporary. And everything you see today is temporary. The idea here is we are looking at the next few decades and looking at trade wars, looking at, I mean, back to your ideas about currencies and everything else, which is the other point. During the same time this is happening, look what happened to the dollar. The dollar went through the roof, okay? Look at the transactions in SWIFT. The gains to the dollar in SWIFT transfers just went through the roof. In a sense, the empire is defending its dollar. It's not going to let it go, just like some people thought. Okay, you know, there is competition and the Chinese will do this and the Russians will do this. No, the empire will defend the dollar. And what we are seeing, if you go throughout history, you will see that the currency of empires decline with the decline of the empire, and they vanish when that empire vanishes. But until that empire is weakened, don't expect that currency to decline.
So do you think Jerome Powell and his reluctance to lower rates is part of this as well?
I don't know. I mean, this is something really I don't know about. But the idea of having or protecting the dollar from the empire, I mean, there is enough support for it. The idea that they are going to let China or Russia do something to it, I think they will let them maneuver within kind of limits, and that's it. But I think there is a big misconception, as we discussed on a previous show, about the loss, the market share loss of the dollar in the international trade. We have to kind of study the landscape to find out the following, that countries that want to get rid of the dollar are all sanctioned countries. To prove that the dollar is losing ground, you need a country that is not sanctioned, with good relationships with the United States and other countries, and telling the world, look, the dollar is not a good choice, and I'm going to move away from the dollar. You want someone with a free will to do it, not someone you sanction and tell them, I'm not going to trade with you. Well, he's not going to trade with you, and therefore he does not need your dollar anyway. He needs your dollar because he's trading with you. So this is not a free will. So the argument that the dollar was losing ground, we need free will countries deciding on their own that I don't need the dollar. We don't have that evidence until today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's extremely chaotic. How much is the election playing into all this? Or a temporary thing? Mentioned.
I don't think the dollar issue is related to the elections at all. I think the other issues, if you look, for example, if you look at the what's happening in Venezuela, the Biden administration made a deal with Maduro that they will lift some of the sanctions, allow foreign companies to go and invest in Venezuela, increase Venezuela's oil production on the condition that he will meet certain conditions for the elections. Of course, a side point here, the U.S. believe that we should not interfere in democracies, but the U.S. is literally interfering in the directly in the Venezuelan elections. Anyway, we knew from the beginning that Maduro is not going to abide by this condition. Now, the Biden administration is threatening that they will reimpose sanctions. But as we said in our reports, don't count on oil to be included in the sanctions. Oil will continue to flow. The Biden administration will allow Venezuela to expand its production. The same way it did the same with Iran, by the way. And one of the things, since we talked about the SPR, people have to realize that there is enough circumstantial evidence to show that there was coordination between the Biden administration and the Iranian regime on releasing the SPR, because they allowed them to release their floating reserves or floating storage at the same time of the release of the SPR. They started together, they ended together. They released about 80 million barrels at the same time. So the Biden administration is not going to embargo or sanction the oil, whether in Iran or Venezuela. One of the reasons why, because they don't want high oil prices before the elections. So probably the dollar has nothing to do with it, but oil has something to do with it. And one of the reasons why they are emphasizing Venezuela, because the Canadians are going to start exporting oil from the West through the Trans Mountain Pipeline very soon. And that's going to divert some shipments from the United States to other places. We don't know yet, but it is very clear to us at least that most of that oil will end up in California anyway. Some of it might go to Asia. But whatever the perception is from the Biden administration and probably some lobbyists, that the Gulf region, I'm talking about the Gulf of Mexico region and the refineries in the Gulf of Mexico that receive the Canadian oil, probably they will have less Canadian oil and they need replacement. And the replacement has to be the same quality. And that quality does not come from Saudi Arabia. That quality does not come from other countries. That quality comes from Venezuela. So by focusing on Venezuela, they are compensating for the possibility of losing some of the oil from Canada.
From what I understand too, Venezuela's oil and gas infrastructure probably needs a revamp due to how deprecated it became post-Maduro coming into power.
The idea of returning to 3 million barrels is not there. We need years and we need massive amount of money to be able to do that. Our estimate, basically, above the current levels, they can really manage to add another 300,000 barrels a day, and that's it. But those 300,000 of a certain quality, they are very important for the refiners on the Gulf Coast.
And we were talking about this before we started recording, and you were tweeting about it at the end of the last week. What's going on in Guyana with their reserves off their coast, and what's the timeline in terms of those actually being tapped into and delivered to market?
Speaking of Guyana, President Mohamed Ali Arfan basically had this interview that went viral.
Yeah, you went viral. Millions of views. You got millions of impressions on X there. It was very impressive. Correct.
Simply because he really kind of, stopped them. He literally told them stop there, and he took over. And that went viral. We have two issues with Venezuela right now. We have the threat, with Guyana. We have the threat of Venezuela taking most of Guyana, because they claimed that that's part of Venezuela. The problem here we have is whatever Maduro is talking about, and you look at the statements, they are identical statements to what Saddam Hussein was saying about Kuwait. Exactly. And the issue here is, when you go back in history, where do you stop? I mean, that applies to many countries around the world, including Israel and Palestine. Where do you stop in history? Where do you go back? Where do you stop? So from Maduro's point of view, they literally cherry-pick certain data and say, well, this land is ours. Well, if they go back, probably the whole Venezuela will be part of Colombia. So we have this issue with Guyana, which is the threat of Venezuela to Guyana. On the other one, we have the problems between Chevron and Exxon, because Chevron bought Hess. Hess is a partner of Exxon, and Exxon did not like it. And now they are going to go back to court and settle these things because Exxon thought they have the first option to buy, and Hess did not do it, and therefore they have priority over Chevron. For us, we published a couple of reports on this. For us, basically, we believe that the purchase of Exxon of Pioneer was a mistake. And we said this from the first moment they announced it, or the rumors basically came out, that this is a mistake. And it is very clear now from the evidence that Exxon probably regret buying Pioneer. They should have bought Hess instead. So Guyana now has those two problems. But if everything goes as planned, their production will more than double by 2030, and they will become a very important country. Back to that interview, the BBC interview with the President Muhammad Ali. One of the ironies is that the guy is from the UK. And one of the things that saved Europe from Putin was the massive exports from Guyana to Europe. They export like 350,000 barrels a day to Europe. So they saved them. They literally saved them. And the guy was telling him, oh, you guys, you know, you produce CO2, et cetera, which is a joke because you produce CO2 when you burn the fuel in the consuming country, you don't burn it as a producer.
Yeah, you're paying to burn it, UK. It was an incredible 2-minute clip to see because it was the hypocrisy of not only the UK, but the West more generally in terms of carbon emissions and the attempt to prevent smaller upstart countries like Guyana pull themselves up from their bootstraps and leverage their natural resources to put their economies in better places is insane. It's like, hey, we got here with all this hydrocarbons and yes, we like the society we live in today, but no, you can't get on par with us. It's really hypocritical.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I do worry though. I do have one worry. It seemed like President Ali was positioning Guyana to be a large exporter of carbon credits with that massive rainforest they have. Are you worried about that at all?
Well, I am. Okay. They already sell carbon credits. They already do. Okay. So everyone is playing the game, although my statement about it is that carbon accounting is the mother of all Enrons. It is the largest scam in history. But hey, if you can make money out of it, take advantage of it.
Yeah. Yeah. The scam, you're just playing in the incentives that you're given. That's what we talk about a lot in the Bitcoin mining industry, because particularly if you're doing like flare gas mitigation, technically you could sell carbon credits. And there's a lot of purists who are like, I don't even want to enable that system. But there's another camp that's like, well, if they're going to give you the money, you should take it while it's on the table.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The last thing we have to touch on, you mentioned it before, narrative battles in the mainstream media pertaining to two big elections that are happening this year. What's going on?
Well, we have elections in India and we have elections in the United States. And there are a couple of mainstream media basically are writing story after story, sometimes like 2-3 stories a day, using true data. I mean, the data is correct, but they are running away with it and producing a complete misconception to serve those two governments. So all the stories about India not buying from Russia are fake. All the stories about India diversifying its oil imports are not correct. The stories that the sanctions are working are not correct. The stories, really the most disturbing stories are about the price cap. Anytime you see a story that says because of the price cap, cancel that story. Because literally the price cap has no impact, period. It's a lie. and it's being promoted time after time after time. And the challenge to anyone is prove it. You have to prove it on two levels. You have to prove it theoretically, in theory, that there is some justification in theory, and then practically through the data. Russian oil being sold above the price cap for months and months. And in fact, even Secretary Blinken, when he went to India, and someone accused India of buying Russian oil above the cap, Secretary Blinken went public saying, no, they are not. In a sense, he is defending them and he's giving them a green light to continue importing from Russia, although the price was $10 above the price cap. So there are multiple stories out there. One of them, of course, we mentioned earlier, the attack on the Russia refineries and the impact. That was exaggerated. Until today, European countries and the United States are importing Russian oil in one way or the other. And the reason why, especially for the EU, when they drafted the sanctions, this is in the draft, so this is written. It says that countries can import Russian oil if it went through transformation. What that transformation means is refining, which means that you, India, go buy that oil, refine it for me, send it to me, and I'm fine. I'm kosher, literally. I'm fine. And that's how that oil basically is coming to Europe, coming to the United States. We have all the data in our reports. Every few days, basically, we publish data on this, which country imported this, which country imported this. And they literally been buying from China and some Arab countries and from India, literally, in a sense, Russian washed oil. It's oil washing. And now we have several stories out of Libya, too, coming that, you know, it's kind of some mafia operations, etc. So there are all kind of games being played. But that oil is flowing to Europe and flowing to the United States.
Shocker, you can't trust the mainstream media, what they're saying.
one of the issues related to that Russian scam and how they operate this, that Turkey is playing a very important role in this. And all you get to do basically is just mislabel that oil in one way or the other. Now, every oil has a DNA, which means that if you want to run an investigation, you can prove that this is Russian oil. But the fact that none of the governments are doing it, that means they want that oil. They want low prices and they want the Russian oil to flow. In fact, that's why we say all the time in our reports that the price cap, the most important impact of the price cap is to legalize buying Russian oil.
Willful ignorance. Just turn a blind eye. Don't see it. So with all this in mind, everything we've covered from shale revolution starting in 2014, the state of LNG, Russia's involvement in OPEC Plus, trying to make sure that they can sell their gas, what's going on in the Red Sea, what's happening in South America, what is your perspective on the next 6 months, 18 months in the oil and gas markets as we head into election season here in the U.S. and India, other parts of the world, as the debt situation spirals out of control, as this war
today
in Ukraine continues?
Today, Brent prices approached almost $90. Some of that increase, basically, if not all of it, is really a political premium. And it is a political premium because Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus and killed 7 people from the Al-Quds Brigade, which is like the best of the best of the Revolutionary Guard of Iran, including 2 leaders. And it is very clear that the Biden administration was panicking. Immediately, they sent a message to Iran. They said, we have nothing to do with it. These are the Israelis. We literally did not participate. We know nothing about it. Why? Because we are coming into elections. And if the Iranians are going to retaliate, they can retaliate in several ways. 2 of them are to literally confiscate, board some tankers as they did before, and confiscate some tankers in the Hormuz Strait and affect shipping there, which goes to Asia, which makes the situation even worse, because now we have the shipments going to Europe, and now on the other side going to Asia, which is another problem. And then they can literally kind of wink at the Houthis and tell them to increase their attacks in the Red Sea and other places, which means that oil prices will go through the roof, LNG prices will go through the roof, and that will create problems for the Biden administration, especially when it comes to oil and gasoline prices. So the market basically received that message. It was very clear that the Iranians are very angry. They will retaliate. We don't know how they are going to retaliate, but that retaliation might affect the oil market. So the increase today is really a geopolitical increase. The way we view it today, of course, things could change tomorrow. So we change our views based on the realities of the market. But based on what we see today, there is no reason for $100 yet in 2024. The market is getting tighter. The decision by OPEC Plus GMMC today not to do anything does not mean that OPEC is going to do nothing, because the voluntary cuts are made, and I hope the audience will pay attention to this because this is very important. The voluntary cuts are made by the individual countries, and the announcements are made by the individual countries, not by OPEC or OPEC Plus. And therefore, the meeting today has no relevance to it, which means that Saudi Arabia and Russia can literally come out tomorrow or after tomorrow and say, well, I'm going to increase my production by 200,000. And there is no contradiction between the two. At the same time, and people got tired of me repeating this, the Chinese are going to use their SPR, and they are going to use their inventories, as they've been doing in recent months. They are going to flood the market with them to prevent prices from going to 100. They've been doing it for years. And the only reason why in 2021 we did not get to 100 was because they released massive amount of oil from their SPR and inventories. So the market is relatively tight, range bound, probably in the 80s, but we will see how things are going to evolve between now and the elections.
Compared to the US SPR, how big is the Chinese SPR?
The Chinese SPR, and okay, this is a very important distinction here. In the United States, the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, is literally owned by the federal government. And when they buy, the money comes from the federal government. And though they sell, the money goes to the federal government. And then we have the commercial inventories, which is the private sector. In China, we do have, their SPR is about 350 million barrels, which is almost kind of close to what the SPR today, almost the same size. But this is not the issue. The issue is the largest holders of the commercial reserves are all owned by the Chinese government. So the definition of strategic petroleum reserve becomes murky here, because if everything owned by the government can do various things as a strategic, make strategic decisions about them, but still classified as commercial, but they are owned by the government. We have what we call the teapot refineries, which is the private sector. They own some reserves. But who is in China is going to say no to the government? So in a sense, from our point of view, all the reserves in China, which is almost 950 million barrels, all of them are strategic. All of them.
Deep reserves they can tap into if need be.
Yes.
Fascinating. Nas, I always learn so much in my worldview. I think you're probably the guest that challenges my worldview, particularly as it pertains to what's happening in the geopolitical landscape in the world of oil and gas every time you come on.
Thank you.
I had a lot of assumptions in my mind around the draining of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve here in the U.S., the administration's stance towards LNG production. And now I've got more things to think about. Completely has me questioning my priors, which I appreciate. Thank you.
Pleasure. Pleasure.
And congrats on going super viral on X over the weekend. I think the last time I checked, you had like 10 million impressions on that.
Yes. It did go viral.
Mm-hmm. Where can anybody who is seeing you on the show for the first time and isn't aware where they can find your Substack, where can they find out more information about you?
The best way and the easiest way basically is go to Twitter, which is my name, Anas Alhaji, AnasAlhajji. And the in the bio, there are the two links. We have a newsletter and we have the daily energy report. There are two different subscriptions in this case. And at the same time, I do a lot of speaking engagements for those who are looking for speakers for their boards or for their annual events or whatever. And I'll be happy to be your speaker.
Anas, thank you. We will link to all that in the show notes as well. As always, it's been a pleasure. Can't wait to do it at some point later this year, probably. Probably around election season.
Have a great day.
Peace and love, freaks. Dickie!